After 20 years of tolerating him, I do remember one thing he taught me when I worked with him for a summer, is that was remember who gets up second, not first. It is good to be with you. As has been stated, this is somewhat home for me. I grew up in Murfreesboro till I was of the age of 13, and we moved away to East Tennessee. And it's something that this has been marked and circled on the calendar for a while. I get to drive by the old house and the old school and see some things and relive some memories and look forward to that. And drive by where I used to attend, I think now still a police station of sorts, and have some of those fond memories. And also many of you remember me as a child, which means that the statement that the prophet's not welcome in his own land is not necessarily true. At least I hope not in our discussions together this week. Been looking forward to this. Some have asked about my mom already. I will tell you, not to make any promises, but she was at my house in Memphis yesterday. She lives in South Carolina, and she's traveling through, and she is somewhat teasing that she's going to stop and join us either tonight or tomorrow. So she may not, but if so, you'll be able to reconnect with her as well. Well, this morning's lesson is not really out of the story of the prodigal son. It is loosely related. We'll get to that after our period of class together. But this morning's lesson is about young people. And it is about the idea that as we look across the landscape of the religious community in our country, young people are walking away from religion. And this is a particular interest to me personally for really three reasons, and I'll share those with you as we begin. The first of those is named Peyton Francis. He is number 68 on the Carville Dragons, and he is 16 years old, junior in high school. He is driving, not always as well as we'd like for him to. We have finally gotten him away from rap music, listening to Ben Rector and Mumford & Sons, which is an improvement, maybe not quite where we want him to be. He's been a Christian for 5 years now. He is active in our young people's group. He's a leader there. He is leading singing on a regular basis, speaks regularly on Wednesday night, says that when he grows up, and if you've seen him, we think he may be there. He's about 6 foot, 270 pounds. That's pretty grown up to us. But he would like to be a preacher. We're trying to talk him out of that. This is number 97 for the 04 Lady Lobos Rush Elite Team. And also number 18 for the Middle School Dragons in Collierville. She's a keeper. Literally, she plays goalie, so she's a keeper. That's the other term for that. She is 12. She's in the 7th grade. She's very spunky, if you've never met Jillian. She's got a lot of energy. She's excited because she gets to go to Chosen Generation, which is our monthly 7th through 12th grade Bible study. It's the first time she's been able to do that. She wants to play college soccer and become a physical therapist and coach soccer. I don't know how she's going to do all that, but we wish her luck in that as well. And then there's Jameson, who yesterday turned 9 years old. She has no number because she's decided she's not an athlete. She'd rather just stay at home and do nothing. We have tried to convince her. Now she's trying tennis because her mom's determined that all three kids will be an athlete. By the way, her mom is behind that, not me. Still loves to play with her American Girl dolls, and she is also the three the most likely to still hug her dad in public winner of our family. She would like to be a teacher or a stay-at-home mom, and she has a great heart. Well, I got to tell you, that's the reason I'm worried about young people, is because of those three. And I'm worried about others, but I'm worried especially about those three. And I'm worried to the extent that I patrol and I watch a lot of their influences. I monitor the music they listen to. I filter it. I control it. I find out they're listening to something they shouldn't. I remove it from their phones. Only the older two have phones, by the way. The youngest one wants one, not getting one for a long time. I worry about their contacts with social media. They're not allowed to be on anything but Instagram, and sometimes that's pulled away from them because of things that I see them doing. There's no Snapchat in our household. Snapchat's the devil. I tell people that all the time. There's no Twitter. There's no Facebook. There's none of that stuff with my kids because I'm worried about the influences they'll see that I can't control. I'm worried about their friends. We do everything but fingerprint and FBI background check their friends. And when they go somewhere, they have to tell us where they're going to be. And they have to tell us when they're going to come home. By the way, just for you parents who don't realize this, this is why the oldest two have an iPhone, is because they tell me where they're going to be, and then I pull up their phones and I see if they're where they said they're going to be. I gave them phones because it allows me to track them. Track them with GPS tracking. There are times I drive by my son driving down the road and I honk and just wave so he knows. I know where you're at. And I worry about all those things. I have it set so I can turn their text messages on my phone. And I can read them. So some of you kids from camp who text my kids, I know what you're texting. And sometimes I'll even answer you and it makes them really mad. But I really enjoy playing that game. I do all of this. Why? Because I'm worried about them being around the wrong friends. I'm worried about getting a call in the middle of the night that my son's been around the wrong friends and he's been out drinking and now he's been arrested. I worry that my daughter's going to grow up and rappel out her second floor window and run off with some guy I don't know who's a loser. I worry about those things. So I go to what some people think are crazy ends to try to prevent that from happening. By the way, I make no apologies for that. It's my job to protect my children as their father. And I make no apology about the fact they have no privacy. There is no privacy in our home. They don't deserve it yet. But I got to tell you, that is not the greatest danger to my kids' souls. The greatest danger to my kids' souls is not that they're going to dive off into some immoral practice, but it's going to be that they just walk away from God altogether. In fact, the statistics are staggering about this. Surveys tell us that 70% of young people walk away from church when they leave home. 70%. And the biggest growing group in America, religiously, is the nuns, we call it, or the no religion group. It's grown by 300% since the 80s. It is stronger and larger than atheists. By the way, 16% of our country are nuns or no religion. And just to give you perspective, we, all of those who claim to be Church of Christ, are 1.5%. 10 times larger than us are people who believe nothing. That's the greatest danger to young people today. And I want to just talk to you in our class about why that happens. And maybe offer some suggestions on what we can do to stop it from happening. Because the reality is, at least in the story of the prodigal son that we're going to read later, that he left. But he did come back. My fear is if I raise my kids in a way that they're allowed to be, quote, non-religious, what are they going to come back to? There's nothing there. And so I'm not saying that this is a foolproof method of keeping my kids from ever walking away from God or from church or from me. But I am saying what I want to do is if that happens, I want them to know they have someone and something to return to. So I hope that we'll be able to study this together this morning. I want to begin, though, by sharing some things that don't work. Because in the religious community, there's a lot of things that have been tried that just don't work. Religious leaders have come up with multiple strategies. I'm sure Wilson's library is like mine. There are books on the shelves that tell me and him how to grow the church, how to keep young people. Probably seen all kinds of articles, blog posts, studies, all of those things. I'm going to kind of compress and boil that down to a few things that didn't work. First off, well, there was changes in music. Religious hymns were removed from assemblies, and I'm talking about from a very generic standpoint across all of the religious landscape. And they were replaced with contemporary music, contemporary praise songs. And quite honestly, some of those praise songs don't say very much. They're catchy tunes, but there's not much meaning to them. Nothing can be slow. Everything has to be upbeat. I'll never forget recently, about a year ago, we're in the Chosen Generation class, and we meet on Sunday afternoons because we're one of those congregations that only meet on Sunday morning. So on Sunday afternoons, we have that class, and we're singing a song, How Deep the Father's Love, which is an amazing song, rich in meaning in its wording. And one of the kids goes, I don't like this song. It's just too slow. Well, that brought on a 20-minute epic rant by the preacher. Because I don't care if a song's slow. What does it mean? And yet, because we are afraid of that response, as religious leaders, we just remove all of that stuff. You might remember the great controversy of about 20 years ago of the traditional assembly and the contemporary worship assembly. Well, guess what happened? It didn't work. Didn't do anything. Didn't change anything. Well, then there was a push to change the dress code. The come-as-you-are mentality of the 90s and the 2000s. And you don't have to dress up for church. Just come like you are. If you're in shorts and flip-flops and a tank top, come on in. And yet that didn't work either. There was a dramatic change in preaching. Because that come-as-you-are approach in the dress code was also accompanied by a stay-as-you-are approach in preaching. No challenges, no changes. Nobody had to be converted. There was nothing but just positives. Steady diet of motivational speaking replaced biblical preaching. And then there was also the emphasis of entertainment. Church had to be fun, exciting. As one kid put it one time, where he went to church was like going to Disney World, only better. Now that sounds exciting. But it didn't work. Simply times were changed. Saturday evenings were offered. Friday evenings, Monday mornings. Everything was attempted and tried. And what I want you to see there is that every aspect that could be motivationally changed to try to encourage young people, don't walk away from us. It was attempted. What was the result? Nothing changed. In fact, young people still walked away at the same rate, if not more. Except there was one change. And that is, we as a nation, as a result of this, we became a bunch of biblically illiterate people. People were raised and they didn't know what the Scriptures taught. They didn't know what was said. It reminds me of Amos back in the Old Testament, where Amos said, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord God, when I will send a famine on the land. Not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. They shall wander from sea to sea, and from north to east, run to and fro to seek the word of the Lord, but they shall not find it. In that day, lovely virgins and young men shall faint for thirst. Those who swear by the guilt of Samaria and say, 'As your God lives, O Dan, as the way of Beersheba lives,' they shall fall and never rise again." I have to tell you, I think that could have been said about a generation of our young people who were raised without anything that resembles biblical teaching. Who hold to some kind of pattern of faith, some of them, but know nothing. And the rest of them, because they know it was empty, they just walked away. And they're fainting of thirst and they're dying of malnutrition because they were never taught anything. And they weren't taught anything because the religious leaders thought that was actually the way to preserve them from leaving. If you look around, that generation of young people from 20 years ago, who ought to be the core of religious groups in our country, who aren't involved, isn't it interesting to see how many groups are now having to close their doors? Because they have no core. Some of those older churches are still older. And those workers from 30 to 45, they're not there. Because we didn't teach them anything. And the other problem is these changes created a self-seeking religion. It became all about me. And what we really did is we changed religion and we changed God and made Him bow down to us instead of us bowing down to Him. And Romans talks about that in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20 there starting, where he says, "For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things." What's interesting about that text when it talks about how that they remove God and they make themselves the focus of everything, that what follows from verse 24 down is a list of sins that are disgusting, actually, and shameful, and yet, sadly, adequately represent the culture we live in. We sometimes wonder, how did we get to where we're at today? Well, we got here because we worshiped ourselves rather than God. That's how we got here. And we allowed ourselves to make up the rules rather than respecting His Word and revering Him. And here's what all the statistics say, by the way. In our country, less than 17% of churches are growing. And of those 17%, only 2% are growing through evangelism or conversion. 98% of religious groups in America are not growing from the outside. And you look at the biblical knowledge. 37% believe the Bible is not accurate. 45% believe that Jesus was not sinless. 57% believe there is another way to eternal life outside of Jesus Christ. 50% believe you can go to heaven in other ways besides Christianity. And 52% don't believe that Satan is real. It shows us that the gimmicks, the strategies, all the plans that were made, they don't work. So why are they walking away? And this has to be asked because if I want to slow this down, well, I've got to be able to understand why it is they're leaving. Why are they doing that? Well, when the nuns are surveyed, the people who aren't religious, what caused this? Here's the four things that they say. By the way, let me say this. This is one of those lessons that about every 10 years I have to reassess. This is like the third version of this. Because with every generation, there comes different answers. But here is the generation that we're talking about, that we're learning from. Number one, because of the hypocrisy they see while being judged by other people. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12, Paul told Timothy there, passage you know well, he said, "Let no one despise you for your youth, but set an example for the believers in speech and conduct and love and faith and impurity." The complaint there that many have is, well, look, I'm trying to do that, and my example is constantly being judged and criticized by some people who aren't living up to the same standard themselves. Hypocrisy has been a long-standing criticism of religious folks. It's a legitimate concern at times. It's like the dad who angrily tells his son as he spanks him, "We don't hit people." And you think about that, and while we understand what he's doing, the reality is there's a part of that that child doesn't understand. And we concern ourselves with tearing them down so much and criticizing everything that they do and every fault that they have. And then as soon as we can, we're on the phone gossiping about brethren, and they have to listen to French fried preacher on the way home from church. And we talk about teaching the truth, while when we're at work, we beg, borrow, and steal, and lie to get ahead. And they see that. And so we criticize young folks while we're hypocritical. Let me tell you something. Young people see through that. And they frankly can't stomach it. And so if we're going to criticize them, and I'm not saying we should not offer assistance and rebuke when rebuke's needed, but we do need to remember to encourage when we can encourage. But if we're going to do all of that, we better make sure we're living right ourselves. And part of that is, when you make a mistake, you admit your mistake to them, especially parents. I can't tell you how many times, before we pray at dinner, I've had to sit down and tell my kids, "Dad messed up today. I didn't handle this right." They need to know we make mistakes too. Because when we act like we never make a mistake, it actually will push them away. I'm going to say this second one, and I will tell you, this is one that people don't like to hear sometimes. But I didn't make this up. People, young people, have walked away from religion because they're tired of politics in the pulpit. And you've got to understand something. Some churches, and I'm not saying that of here, because I've not been here. Some churches combine political agendas with the gospel of Jesus Christ. That especially happens every 4 years, like now. And I will tell you as a side note, I'm one of those people that I'm kind of thankful we are where we are right now so we can understand something. Those guys aren't going to save you. It's about time that we have to face a choice where we can't even reasonably argue that someone is even relatively close to the truth to understand. That's not the answer. But for years, we have presented that as the answer. And let me make sure you understand something. When preachers promote politics from the pulpit, young people understand that's not what Jesus died for. And they're tired of that. And they don't want to hear your political agenda. Not from the pulpit. And we've got to respect that. Thirdly, they walk away because of isolationism. Now, what does that mean? We sometimes, and not just religious leaders, but Christians in general, we have a way of demonizing everything that's not the way we do it. And we do that, quite frankly, because we're in a competition to see who's going to get to heaven first and who's more spiritual than the other person. And we do that with everything. Secular music is sinful. Public school is wicked. All of culture is evil. Technology is sinful. And we categorize all of these things. And we do that, and our young people hear that. Let me tell you what's funny is that our congregation, in a group of about 25 to 30 young people from the age of 7th grade to 12th grade, I have homeschool kids, I have public school kids, I have private school kids. I can get them together in the room, and I don't hear any of the nonsense about which is better. Put their parents in the room, and that's all you can talk about. Because we isolate ourselves about everything. And see, I'm going to tell you, too, that I'm tired of us doing that as a church. I'm tired of there being black churches and white churches, or homeschool churches and public school churches. And we use those phrases. I know we do. I've heard it. There's only one church. And we shouldn't be isolating ourselves based on all those things. Let me say something that's going to, again, some of you old folk, this is where we're going to have a division. When it comes to technology, can I encourage you to be careful what you say? We have a lot of kids that this is their Bible or their phone. Now, I will tell you guys, if I'm your high school teacher, I have a place on the door in the back of the classroom. You got to turn your phone in when you walk in my class. You know why that is? It's not because I'm against the Bible app on your phone. It's because out of 20 of you, there's 3 knuckleheads who are playing games. And so because of the 3 knuckleheads, the rest of you suffer. But I am not that guy that says, well, I just can't stand these phones today and all these kids having Bible apps. Whatever happened to a real Bible with paper? Here's why. My son can take his phone to school with him every day. And he can pull out his phone and he can read a psalm at lunchtime. Or in the locker room before he goes to workouts, he can open up and he can read a text. And it provides an opportunity for him to be connected to God's Word in ways that, quite frankly, this makes more difficult. I'm not saying there aren't times that we need to remind people, hey, the Bible is also an object made of paper with a nice cover on it that you can hold in your hand. I like that a lot. But we don't need to isolate ourselves and just say, all that's evil. Which I have heard people say. That pushes young people away. Because whether you like it or not, that's how they communicate. I'm worried about our kids' safety because of that. My kids can't walk without looking at a phone. They're going to run into a wall sometime. But I understand that's who they are. And what that means really is we have to be balanced. And we have to know when things are okay and when things aren't. And what we say has to present that balance. Now, fourthly, some people just walk away because of immorality. I mean, that is true. Don't be naive, parents. Christian Leadership Journal says that young Christian singles are just as sexually active as their non-church friends. That's just a reality. And now, that article, unfortunately, goes on to criticize churches for having harsh judgment towards promiscuity. And the point is, we can't change the message about immorality. We can't step back and go, hey, look, it's okay. No, it's not okay. And some people are always going to walk away because of this. We still have to teach. And we have to realize that's a problem. But I have to tell you that all this study made me want to dig a little deeper, because on the surface, those four things are interesting and they make sense to me as a parent of a teen and as a guy that's much younger than Wilson. They make sense to me and I understand them. But I came across some research by Focus on the Family entitled Millennial Faith Participation and Retention. And the purpose of this study was to go deeper than this stuff. It was actually to figure out, why did this stuff happen? Why are these things what's causing the problems? And here's what they found. That the overwhelming response to this study was this. The reason young people who grow up in the church, use that loosely, and walk away from religion is because their claim is they had no solid religious upbringing to begin with. Here's what they said. 11% of those surveyed said that when they were children, strong faith was exemplified in the home and vibrant Christianity was practiced and taught. That means 89% of those surveyed said that Christianity was not practiced and taught in their home. It was not exemplified. It was not something that they saw. So what this study found out by Focus on the Family is that the real problem that these young people were having is that they were not brought up in faith-driven homes. Their homes are motivated by other factors like education or recreation or career or family bonds, but they weren't motivated by faith. Which leads me to this conclusion. We do not have a child crisis in the church. And we don't have a faith crisis in the church. We have a parenting crisis in the church. We have a parenting crisis in our country. Anybody here from Paducah, Kentucky? Raise your hand. Good. There's a baseball team from Paducah, Kentucky staying in my hotel. I went to breakfast this morning. I have never seen an 8-year-old take a cannonball dive off a sofa table onto a couch while his mother watched before. And I videoed it when they were somewhat settled down and sent it to my wife. And I know if I got caught, that could be bullying. I'm not posting on social media. But my daughter plays travel soccer. We don't travel much. When we do, they're always very behaved. But I sent her this video and I said, believe it or not, that's them well behaved. And she said, are they on the furniture? I said, no, they're diving off the furniture onto other pieces of furniture. One mother came up and she said, come on, I need you to help me figure out what you want to eat. She said it 3 times. He said no. She just walked away and then he dove back onto the couch. Let me tell y'all something. First off, some of you knew my dad, and this is the same response he would have had. If I was their dad, they wouldn't be able to run the bases today. We have a parenting crisis. And so when we ask the question, well, how do we stop it? Well, the way we stop it is not really, it's not my job as the preacher. It's not Wilson's job. It's not the elder's job. In fact, I got to tell you, that's one of our problems is we outsource everything. We send our kids to school and then we don't want to do their homework. In fact, that's one of the complaints. My kids have too much homework. You know why parents claim about too much homework? Because they don't want to be bothered with it. And we've done the same thing with spiritual education. Your child can't get enough Jesus 2 hours a week here. Doesn't happen that way. And so we have a parenting problem. And the reality is, I don't want to sit back and watch Peyton and Jillian and Jameson walk away from God. Now, they may ultimately decide to do that. They have the free will choice. I know Proverbs says, train up a child in the way he should go. When he's old, he won't depart from it. That's not an absolute. My child still can choose, if I do the best job possible, they can still choose to go headlong into the pleasures of this world and not serve God. But it's my job to make sure that I do everything I can do to stop them from doing that. and to give them the foundation that if they do, they know where they can come back. So let me give you four things. Number one, teach them. Teach them. It is my job to teach my kids, not in the role as a preacher, but as in the role of their father. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, in these last 30 days of Moses' life, when he is telling the people of Israel, here's what's really important. It's amazing to me what he says here in verses 4 through 9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words I command to you today shall be on your heart. Verse 7, you shall teach them diligently to your children. And you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall bind them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Let me tell you what that really means, dads. It means that teaching your children about Jesus is not just bringing them to church. It also means that teaching your kids about Jesus is not just having a prayer and devotion with them in the morning or the evening before they go to bed. What it means is that you, as a spiritual leader in your home, seize every opportunity you can find to teach them about the Lord and the need to serve the Lord. At a young age, when you are driving your three-year-old around and there's a rainbow in the sky, what Deuteronomy 6 means is that you stop and instead of talking about how beautiful the rainbow is, you remind your three-year-old that rainbow is an eternal covenant from God that He will not destroy the world by water again. That's a sign, a thousands of years old sign that God has still kept that promise. Do we do that? We don't. Because we're too busy taking a picture to post on Instagram about the beautiful rainbow. Teach your children. When you tell them they can't do something, don't just say no. Tell them why. My son, at our house, one of those dad rules has always been, we don't do dances. Period. You want to argue with me later, we can argue about why. But we don't do dances. And I don't bind that on anybody else, but that's my house. So we went through that with my son, and my son kind of got upset, and I finally said, look, here's why I don't want you going. Here's all the temptations. But if you're not comfortable telling your friends that, you just say, hey, my dad's a mean old man. He won't let me go. That's what he told his friends. Their parents came and said, why won't you let him go? And I said, what'd you hear? Well, they said, you're a mean old man. Well, they said, that's exactly why I won't let him go. I'm a mean old man. I won't let him go. My 12-year-old daughter. Why can't I go to the dances like everybody else? I explain why. But what's funny is the 16-year-old now hops in. Because things are happening with his 12-year-old sister. She's starting to look more like a woman than a little girl. And by the way, he don't like it one bit. To the point that he has even told one of the football coaches who's a gym teacher at her school, watch out for any guy that talks to my sister and let me know who they are. You know, the coolest moment was to hear the 16-year-old tell the 12-year-old why she couldn't go to the dance. He was able to do that because when he was 12, he was taught. That's what Deuteronomy 6 is talking about. And the reality is, these verses aren't saying, get your kids to Sunday school. They're saying, teach your kids. Don't outsource the spiritual education of your child. Teach them. Secondly, convert them. Sometimes we do a good job at teaching our kids. They can tell us the 12 sons of Jacob and the 12 tribes. They memorize stories. They memorize verses. They can tell us the 27 books of the New Testament, the 39 of the Old Testament. Sometimes they add that 67th book of the Concordance, and that's okay. We teach them all of these facts, but they don't know what it means to change. Let me tell you what's sometimes wrong is we bring our kids to church every week. They go to Bible class. They have their lessons done most of the time. We raise them with a sense of morality. We don't let them disrespect other people. We won't let them jump on couches at breakfast in a hotel. We watch everything they listen to, they watch. We compare them to other kids, the neighbor kids who are always in trouble, or the kids jumping on the hotel furniture. And we look at ourselves and say, you know what? I got really good kids. Let me tell you a harsh reality. Good kids don't go to heaven. Saved kids go to heaven. And sometimes we raise good kids, but we never change them. Romans 12, I appeal to you there, verses 1 and 2. I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by the testing you may discern what is the good will of God, what is good, acceptable, and perfect. Teach your kids to be a living sacrifice. Actually convert them to being a disciple. Make them learn to give up everyday things in order to be right with God, to submit to the Lord. That's what it means to be converted. We don't just need to teach them. We need to show them what it means to change. Because you can raise good kids, but good kids don't go to heaven. Saved kids do. And then equip them. In Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 through 12, Paul says that he gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of the ministry, for the building up of the body of Christ. When it comes to equipping people to serve, it is the church's job to do that. Leadership has to take a concerned interest in, are we teaching people and showing them and giving them everything they need in order to actually be servants of God? So it's our job as leaders to do that. But well before the church can ever equip your children, you as a parent start equipping them yourself. And the passage that brings that to mind for me is 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 14. Where there Paul says, as for you, continue to in what you have learned and firmly believe, knowing from whom you've learned it, and how from childhood you've been acquainted with the sacred writings that are able to make you wise for salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. And he goes on to say, all Scripture is breathed out by God and is profitable. And we know that passage. But from childhood you learned the things that you were supposed to say and do and how you were to act. What's interesting is at the end of verse 17, it says that the Scriptures equip us for every good work. So get this. Paul tells Timothy, you've known the Scriptures from childhood that equip you to do good works. When you teach your children the Scriptures, you're equipping them to work. Include them in your work. Involve them in the process. Hey, there are times in the summer when our kids are out of school, and we've got some big project going on. Maybe it may be something as simple as cleaning up a storage room at the building. Or maybe it's assembling some kind of book. They go work. They're part of the work even before they're Christians. Why? I want to equip them to realize you have a life of service ahead of you. Teach them how to do that. Final thing. We're almost out of time. Show them. Show them. Everything up to this point has been instructional. It's a lot of talking. Teach them, convert them, equip them. That's all kind of extensions of the same idea. It's a way of illustrating to you that it's more than just teaching them the stories, but it's actually taking them and applying them, helping to change your child, show them how to live and act as a Christian from the Scriptures. But what we have to finally do is we have to actually show them all of this. It does no good for me to tell my kids to do something if I'm not going to do it myself. See, 1 Timothy 4:12 says, let no one despise your youth, but be an example in speech and faith and conduct and love and purity. And we say those things, but can I tell you that that's not just to young people. I know he says, let no one despise your youth, but aren't we all supposed to do that? Let me give you one illustration of where I know we're falling short of this. I get frustrated. I don't teach the high school class right now. I think they're thankful for that. I don't know. Maybe we should interview them about that. But the last time I did, I noticed there's a large percentage of them who never had their lesson done. Now I'm teaching the adult class right now. Guess what? There's a large percentage of them who never had their lesson done. And oddly enough, those two groups are related. You know why young people don't do their lesson? Because mom and dad don't do their lesson. The reason why young people aren't invested is because mom and dad aren't invested. The reason why young people aren't involved is because mom and dad aren't involved. And I got to tell you something. You can do those first three things all you want. You can preach and preach and preach at your kids. But unless you actually put into action what you're saying, they don't care. And they're more honest than we are. Because those are the kids that are walking away. And they've determined and decided that they're not going to be hypocrites like their parents and claim to be Christians but not live like it. See, that's the real problem. The real problem is because we're not living like Christians, our kids aren't going to be Christians. Bible says that it's the third generation that leaves. Years ago, I had time with Ed Harrell, who has studied all of the problems, and he said, it's the same thing. Every third generation, they see through the weak faith of their parents, and they leave. The reason why the prodigals are walking away from religion is because we're not showing them what it means to live for Jesus. Thanks for your attention this morning.